Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears back with you here, Wednesday, July the 8th, 2026, 14 minutes past the hour. And we have a guest on this hour that I have been looking forward to having on for quite a long time, because I certainly am a fan of his father's. And with everything going on with the Democratic Party these days, I think it's good to look back at one of the most well-known, well-loved, well-liked legislatures ever in the Democratic Party here in the United States. I speak of former Speaker of the House for 10 years, 1977 to 1987, the legendary Tip O'Neill. Who would know him better than our guest today? He is a former state legislator, and former Lieutenant Governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. He is Tip O'Neill's oldest son, Tom O'Neill. Tom, thanks so much for joining us today.
Scott, it's nice to join you. Thanks very much for having me.
Tom, I recently caught an episode of your father after he wrote his book in 87, 88. He was on the Phil Donahue Show. It's on YouTube. People can watch it. If you look at this, this guy's personality just jumps off the screen. Was he like that in private?
He was a joy to live with, to be very honest with you. He had a great sense of humor, a wonderful perspective on life, a very practical guy, always ready for a good laugh, and he was just wonderful to be around.
What was it like growing up with him as a father?
Well, we came from, a middle-class background, a neighborhood in North Cambridge, Massachusetts. And there wasn't much money, but in those days, nobody knew it. And the sense of community really was everywhere around you. If your mother went out to the store, the neighbor next door would keep an eye on you. And the kids all went out to play, and it was really unstructured. If you were a young man, you probably went out and played baseball. If you were a young woman, you went out and did something with the girls. But it was pretty easy growing up with them. I never realized the privilege that we had until I was a little older, a young teen, and began to understand that people really appreciated and respected my father in a way that was not quite ordinary. But, you know, he instilled a practical side to us, and he was a disciplinarian, as was my mom. And they made sure that we all kind of stayed, all five of us stayed on the right side of everything. And we were told from a very early age, if you get in trouble, you're on your own, because you're not going to embarrass his family. It was structured in that sense. It was fun in that sense, and we began to understand what privilege can be when you're Tip and Millie O'Neill's son or daughter.
Where did the name Tip come from?
It's a great question. It comes from a turn of the century, the 19th century, baseball player Steve O'Neill, who went up to bat. I don't know what team he played for. I don't recall that, but he went up to bat in the big leagues, and they couldn't strike him out. And if he didn't get the pitch he wanted, he'd tip it off. And he fouled it off. And hence the name Tip O'Neill. My father was an avid baseball fan. He liked the idea of having the same nickname, and that's what they called him.
It's very interesting, because if you Google your father's name, of course Speaker of the House comes up, and there still are a lot of mentions of his book that he wrote in 87, but the quote, "All politics are local." Where did that come from?
It came from his first campaign, to be very honest with you. He was running for state representative as a senior in college, and it's the only election he lost. And he went across the street to meet a neighbor by the name of Mrs. O'Brien. And he said, after he'd lost, he said to her, "I hope you voted for me." And she said, "You know, Tip, everybody likes to be asked." And he realized at that moment in time, not only do people like to be asked, but politics is local. It's retail, and the people like to be asked. And it just implanted, ingrained in him, you know, that slogan, and he carried it for the rest of his life.
You know, Tom.
And if you think about it, almost everything we deal with in politics, whether it's international, national, or local, all politics is local.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking about this quote, Tom, because it was so associated with your father and was so popular. In the age of the internet, do you think this has changed at all? Because if you look at a lot of the states now, if there's a gubernatorial race or a presidential race, this really helps people in local communities, the down-ticket vote.
No question about it. So I'm not sure I understand the question completely, but... you know, in the days of my dad and his running for political office, it was really a game of retail politics. You had to get out and know people, talk to people, understand what was on their mind. When I came into politics, it was a combination of retail politics, sure, but wholesale as well. Radio and television played very, very importantly. Today, with the internet, it's retail, wholesale, and retail again. You have to know your audience. You have to know what it is that they want to hear about, and you have to talk to them.
I guess the question was, are all politics still local when we see that Donald Trump will win a state with 70% of the vote, and the local politicians will get 67 to 72% as well?
Well, that happens everywhere, and it's historic in nature. I mean, the top of the ballot oftentimes has an effect on the bottom of the ballot. People running for lesser-known seats, for more local or statewide seats. There's no question.
What was it like having Tip O'Neill as a father as you grew up, as you got older?
He ingrained upon us the importance of government and service. He really viewed what he did in politics, whether it was local when he was a state legislator, when he was a state speaker of the House, or when he ran for Congress and was successful, he really believed that job and that service was noble, and he carried that through life, and he instilled that on us. To be very honest with you, every one of my sisters and brothers over the years has done something in the public eye to create a service, usually at the community level, but an important level, whether it's housing or food or healthcare. Every one of us has done something to make sure that we've enriched our local communities.
Tom, I know you helped him run some of his campaigns. What was it like working for him and working on campaigns in those days?
It was different. The relationship was one time of the day, it'd be a father-son relationship. Another part of the day, it would be a business relationship. And that's right, I'm the only O'Neill that stayed in Massachusetts while others moved to Washington with my dad. I was the oldest boy, and in the Irish family, the tradition was the oldest son gets the farm. There was no farm in the O'Neill house. There was a campaign, and I got it. What was interesting about that was that he followed direction very, 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 very keenly. He paid attention, and he had a great instinct. I mean, all you had to do was make a suggestion, and in his gut, he would feel it to be the right thing or the wrong thing, and he'd come back and challenge if he didn't like or agree with what it was you were saying. But it didn't happen very often, to be very honest with you. We set up, you know, a daily schedule for him, and he paid attention to it and followed it. And he gave his own speech, his own topics, during the course of any speech that he made, because he understood the crowd that he was working and talking to. But he understood his district as well as anybody.
Mm. Being a Democrat, in his era, in his time, what did that mean to him?
Well, he was really a child of FDR, to be very honest with you. I mean, his great heroes in politics were Abraham Lincoln, Al Smith, the governor of New York, who ran for president of the United States back in 1928, and he was the first Catholic to run for president. That had a great effect on my dad. And FDR, of course, who he came to know over the years. And he just appreciated what each of them had given, the sacrifices each of them had made, and the success that each of them gave because they were courageous and unafraid.
Do you think being a Democrat today and being a Democrat then are the same things?
Well, when my dad was the Speaker of the House, he had 14 different philosophies under the Democratic Party umbrella. I don't think people understand that. If you were from the Deep South, you were a more moderate or a conservative Democrat, a blue Democrat, blue state Democrat in the North, were more progressive, more liberal. But somehow the genius of my dad, frankly, was able to balance the 14 different philosophies from around the country and get things done and get people to agree. He understood, as did most politicians who were successful in that era, the art of negotiation. And that's what they believed, that politics and getting elected was an art form for negotiating progress, getting people to move forward with agreement. They may not get 100% of what they want, but they got enough to move ahead and keep the country strong.
You know, it's interesting. There seems to be a problem today with keeping different philosophies within a party together in that same party. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with the way we communicate today. But in the era of my dad, back in the 70s and 80s when he was Speaker, Republicans talked to Democrats, and all Democrats talked to each other. They not only talked on the floor of the House, they not only talked by telephone, they socialized family to family. And they made sure that they socialized and got along. If they had a baseball game, they had everybody on the team on both sides. If the House Republicans were playing the Democrats, everybody played and everybody got along. And all their families came along.
And now that certainly is not the case.
It doesn't happen that way. It's too divisive today, to be very honest with you. Mm. Created in the late 80s and 90s and continued on. I mean, it really began to dissipate after the era of Ronald Reagan and my father.
You know, and that's an interesting relationship. I want to get to that before the program's up today. But Tip becomes Speaker of the House in 1977, just as Jimmy Carter is becoming president. What was it like for him to become Speaker of the House?
To be honest with you, the first introduction was not a healthy one between the president and my dad. The people around Jimmy Carter viewed my father as a roadblock on Pennsylvania Avenue. And they treated him that way for the first, I'd say, 3 or 4 months. And when my father, you know, stalled something they wanted in the House, they began to come around to understand that it's a government of three divisions. You've got the Congress, the presidency, and the courts of the United States, the Supreme Court of the United States. And there's supposed to be a balance of power. And I think they didn't recognize that they had run. Don't forget, Jimmy Carter was an outsider. He was really not part of Washington. And he didn't understand Washington for the first moments of his administration. But they learned to have a wonderful relationship in the last 3 years of Jimmy Carter's term.
Then President Reagan comes in. And
yes.
and people to this day think that was a very good relationship. How would you characterize the relationship between your father and President Reagan?
Very healthy. A very healthy one. But before that, my father helped Jerry Ford, the Republican leader in Congress, become the President of the United States after Richard Nixon. The relationship they had was extraordinary. I mean, they were really best friends. Ford on the Republican side, my dad on the Democratic side, as they were both going through the leadership rungs on the ladder. And my father had it always felt that if a man is elected president, you've got to give him leeway to get his programs in place. He's been elected, the people elected him, they want to see what he can do. Not only was Ronald Reagan very, very genteel and understanding of the Washington side of things, but he surrounded himself with very strong people who my father liked very much in his administration. And because of those two things, the relationship of the Reagan staff and the person Ronald Reagan was, as affable as he was, and as willing to kind of go along with my father on some things that meant a lot to my dad, that relationship really worked. And the truth of the matter is, they did have a drink after work every once in a while, where they got together and they laughed. and they enjoyed one another's company.
You know, it's very interesting. Everything you said is exactly true. But yet, when your father's book came out after he had left his position as Speaker of the House in 1987, he was very critical of Ronald Reagan in his book and even, I think, called him the worst president that he had ever worked with.
I don't remember that in the book, but I do think this. I think that my father viewed him, frankly, as an Irishman, as my dad was, an Irish-American, but he came from a different side of the Irish equation. He was conservative in nature, by nature, and they didn't understand each other at first blush. But because of Reagan's affability and my dad's affability, they just got along. I think early on he thought that Reagan wasn't going to be that good or strong a president, and he questioned his ability. And I think Reagan, working together with domestic issues, worked very well with my dad. And internationally, he made a name for himself, obviously, too.
How hard was it to deal with somebody like Ronald Reagan, who won 49 states the second time around during his second election, being the Speaker of the House, being the legislative branch of government?
I think, you know, he won an overwhelming majority of the American people over because of his personality and his ability to get things done. But that was his ability at the tail end of his first term to work with Congress and get his measures through. And again, there was a willingness on the part of not only my dad, but the others in leadership in the House and the Senate, for that matter, that wanted the president to succeed where he could, if they could agree and work out compromise that would keep the government going.
You know, another interesting relationship your father talks about in his book is the relationship with the Kennedys. Says he loved Jack Kennedy, but definitely not a fan of Bobby Kennedy's.
He loved Jack Kennedy. First of all, he replaced Jack Kennedy in Congress. When Jack Kennedy ran for the Senate, the U.S. Senate, back in 1952, that's when my father left his seat in the State House of Representatives as Speaker to run for Kennedy's seat. And he got to know Jack Kennedy very well and liked Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a very affable man with a great sense of humor and very smart. Bobby was rigid, very rigid, and he was the campaign manager. And he ruffled feathers in that campaign for Jack's presidential run. And he ruffled a lot of personal feathers of friends of my dad. And I think that just gave a bitter taste in my father's mouth of Bobby.
Now,
on the other hand, all the O'Neill kids were with Bobby Kennedy when he was running for president.
So there was somewhat of a good relationship.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. And then Teddy came along, and, you know, I was the Middlesex County coordinator for Teddy when he ran for the Senate the first time. And, you know, there's been a great relationship between the Kennedys, all the Kennedys, including all of Bobby's kids. You know, we've worked together in campaigns for the Kennedys and others around the country.
You know, that book that I'm referring to, Man of the House, 1988, by Tip O'Neill, also had some interesting assertions in it, basically implying that the election of 1960 between Nixon and Kennedy there was some funny business in that election on the Kennedys' part. Now, I think your father did go on to say that Jack Kennedy didn't know about it because he was the candidate and the campaign was doing what it was doing. But I remember him getting a lot of flack at that time, your father, for asserting that.
I think my father believed that there were shenanigans going on in Texas with the Texas count for Nixon. And the counterbalance was the Daley folks in the Chicago area of Illinois had waited on counting votes until they knew where Kennedy was. So I think both things happened. I you know, whether in fact they happened or not, I couldn't tell you. And I don't think Jack Kennedy as a candidate did know. Yeah. I don't think any candidate was aware of that, to be very honest with you.
When your father was writing that book, when you looked at it, was there anything that surprised you?
After the book came out, I got a call. My father got a call, and I answered the phone at his house. And on the phone was a Philadelphia Inquirer reporter. And he said, you know, I'm doing a fact check, and there's something in the book that that doesn't come through on me. So I turned to my father, and I said, it's a reporter from the Inquirer in Philadelphia. I said, he thinks this is a history book. You know, what it was a memoir, and people ought to remember that.
When did he enjoy writing the book and going out on the book tour?
I think he was overwhelmed by the success of the book. It was a best-selling memoir, I think, in history at that time. It sold an awful lot of copies. And it had a resurgence again a couple of years later when a second book came out. I was astonished by the success of the book, to be very honest with you. But there was wonderful humor in the book and great political stories in the book and wonderful lessons to be learned in the book, along with his memory. You know, it was wonderful that way. It was very entertaining. Mm. I hope you felt that way.
Yeah, it's a very, very entertaining book, but there are some things in there, as I said, and I think the Donahue show I referred to earlier, he's selling the book on the show, and Donahue, who obviously was a big-time liberal Democrat, is shocked about some of the things he says about the Kennedys and so on and so forth, and it's a fascinating interview to watch.
Yeah, well, he did a series of interviews, and he just told it like it was. I mean, there was no magic other than that in that book.
Was there any spin with Tip O'Neill, or did he just tell it how it was?
Yeah, he was not prone to exaggeration. As a matter of fact, if he caught one of his kids exaggerating, it kind of cool their jets down a little bit and correct them and counsel them. So he didn't exaggerate. He might have viewed something differently. Out of his sense of humor, he might have viewed something differently because he had an interaction with somebody along the way that he didn't like. I don't know, and it might have caused a way of viewing things for him that might prove to be inaccurate. I don't know.
He's Speaker of the House from 1977 to 1987. Obviously, that's a very big job, time-consuming. How did that impact his relationship with his family, his grandkids at the time?
He took great pains to make sure that he spent time with my mother. She had moved to Washington at that point, where beforehand she was bringing up the kids in Cambridge. And as we all got out of school, she then went down to and lived with my dad, which he had always wanted, and he believes that everybody in Congress ought to have their families in Washington or wherever they're spending most of their time, the members are spending most of their time, just to be around family and the great friendships. But he always took time with the kids. I mean, he was home every weekend, and as young kids, he'd always take us bowling every Saturday or play baseball with us, or he'd do something. And he made sure that he spent time on Saturday and Sunday, and then we had a family dinner on Sunday afternoons. And that was sacrosanct. The grandchildren, as they came along, my son is an actor in New York, and he's been an actor all his life. He just loved the stage. And he did great impersonations, and he did an impersonation of George H.W. Bush. And my father took him to the White House to do the imitation to the president. I mean, it was something. It was something. And he paid attention to it. And he paid attention to all the kids.
You know, it's very interesting. George H.W. Bush, who came after your father had left politics, this was Father Bush, President Bush number one. Your father really seemed to like him.
Liked him very, very much. They'd served together in Congress. They knew one another. And they were personally friendly. And my father was on, I don't know, some family board created by the Bushes, which took some time from his daily schedule a couple of times during the course of the year after he was out of politics. And he kept very close communication. And I can remember running into the president long after that, and he would regale you with stories about him and my dad.
What part did your mother play in his life?
First of all, when he wasn't there at the house because he was in Washington and away from Cambridge, she had the role of father and mother. And so she was a disciplinarian. She was, you know, she watched out for us and made demands where they needed to be made on all five of us. But she had iron on one side and feathers on the other. I mean, she was wonderful. She was just wonderfully soft with my dad, and she knew BS when she heard it from somebody. And if she thought somebody was giving my father a hard time or doing something wrong, she would be quick to point it out. So she reminded him every time there was an election. You know, he'd say, "Millie, I hope you're going to vote for me." Well, except you didn't ask, but if you ask me, I will.
So a good marriage, good long marriage.
Oh, it was a very strong marriage, yeah.
You know, also, after your father left his position as Speaker of the House, something that some people criticized, some people really liked, he ended up doing a string of commercials for several different businesses, Miller Lite, and things of that nature. How did he get involved with commercials?
He was really popular. He was smart enough to get out of politics at the top of his game and didn't linger. He was 77 when he left politics and felt that the 50 years he'd spent in government, he had done enough and it was somebody else's turn. And he believed that strongly. So when he walked into a room, in Washington, he'd get a standing ovation. Even, you know, for years after he got out of the office of Speaker, he really carried that popularity. And I think the marketplace saw that and they wanted him to do an ad here, an ad there, and he did them. He had never made money before, and you know he just saw an opportunity to help build a second home on Cape Cod, which he did, and leave something to his kids after he was gone, and he did that too.
You know, it's very interesting for you to say that he did not make money with his job as a politician. Now, certainly, there's a lot of talk about that today. With the president and a lot of people in Congress and trading stocks and so on and so forth, how people are listening would say, how is it possible he did not make money?
First of all, he didn't care about it. He honestly did not care about it. He loved doing what he was doing. He loved getting out of bed in the morning and shaking people's hands, talking to people, and going to Washington and doing his job. And that fulfilled him.
Yep.
You know, I've been told, I had a friend who went to school with me in graduate school, but he was a Republican, and he helped run the campaign of one of the candidates running against my dad. And he was a prosecutor in Boston, as was the candidate. And he said after the race was over, he said, you know, it's an astonishing thing. He said, we investigated your father's legacy and, pardon me, life. We looked at everything we possibly could, and we couldn't find a thing on any of you. And I said, you know, it's just a great compliment.
I was doing some research for this interview, Tom, and is it true that when your father was out of office, he did commercials for Trump Shuttle? Oh, I think we lost Tom. Hold on. Hopefully we get Tom back here momentarily. Bob Walsh is in the studio. Bob, how are you enjoying this interview with Tom O'Neill?
Very good. And I just want to say I did not move. I did not knock any wires out.
I think we've got him back here. We're rejoined. I don't know. Technical difficulties here by Tom O'Neill, the oldest son.
We're back.
Yeah,
we're back.
Tom, the question I had was, is it true that your father did commercials after he was out of office for Trump Shuttle?
He did. Donald Trump had called. Trump had bought the shuttle from Eastern Airlines, and it was really the shuttle between Boston and Washington, yeah, New York, Washington, and Boston. And he wanted my father to do the ad, and my father cut the ad, he cut the tape, and did the voiceover, and it ran for about a week. And Trump called my brother Kip, who was a lawyer in Washington, and he said, I don't like the ad. I'm going to cut it. And my brother said, well, what are you doing? He said, I just don't like it. He said, you know, your father's a little overweight. To which my brother kept saying, didn't you ever see him before you asked him? but I will say this, he lived up to the contract.
Well, that's good. That's good. We've heard in other cases that might not have been the case. Did your father have any thoughts on him at the time?
No, he wouldn't have even thought about him, to be very honest with you.
You know, it's very interesting, since we know what has happened since, obviously, Trump becoming president, that he would hire this very popular Big D Democrat, former Speaker of the House, to help move his product. Do you have any thought on Donald Trump's political philosophies? Do you think he has a political philosophy?
No, I don't. I don't think there's a core. I think he hired my father because he thought my father would help him sell the Eastern Airlines than the Trump shuttle. I know Donald Trump over the years enough to know that he's given to as many Democrats campaign donations as he did to Republicans, because I think he viewed each one of them as somebody that could help him along the way. I don't know where this... I mean, he was a liberal at some point in his life. He's been reported talking about things like abortion much earlier in his life, when he was on another side than he is today. I think he finds himself on the way, that on the side of things that are going to inure benefit to him.
Your father left his position as Speaker of the House, his political career, in 1987 after 50 years. You say he was ready to go, but was it hard for him to leave a life like that and a position like that behind?
I think he missed it. Absolutely. And what I think he missed was being relative. And I think that took a toll on him, to be honest with you. I mean, he had a very small place in North Miami. He couldn't play golf 6 days a week. He wasn't going to do it. And he wasn't going to play cards 6 days a week. I mean, he wasn't built that way. He needed to be doing something with his life.
Was there any other reason that he left beside the fact that he had been there 50 years? Did he feel that maybe the party was changing, the times were changing?
No, I think, honestly, he had had a couple of things with diabetes. He was slowing down a little bit at his age. And I think he just felt it was time to give somebody else an opportunity.
Those 6 years that he spent in retirement before his passing in 94, what were those years like?
I think he enjoyed family. I think he enjoyed, you know, Cape Cod. They sold their house in Cambridge because they weren't there often enough. And the house on the Cape became a family compound, although it was just one single family house. It had enough bedrooms to have, you know, at least one of the families in at one time, along with my mother and him. And so he enjoyed the Cape, and he enjoyed his friends on the Cape. And he played golf a couple of days a week, and he enjoyed that. He volunteered at the family pantry on Cape Cod, which he loved. He raised a little money for them, which has become a family tradition over the years. All the family does that today for that family pantry. It kept him busy enough. But I also think it wore on him, and I think the fact that he wasn't working, wasn't using his mind as he once had, I think that began to debilitate him, to be honest with you.
You know, it's interesting. One thing people will remember from his retirement, he did a lot of public spots for cancer. He was, I believe, diagnosed with colon cancer.
Yes.
When did that come about, and what toll did that take on him?
It took a terrific toll on him. He had a colonoscopy, and he had that for about the last 2 years of his life. But he chose to make it public because he wanted to show people what can happen, even to people who had that kind of power. They're just human beings, and he showed them how to live with it. And he realized there was a bond and a group of people that it had it that he never knew about. He had a very good friend, Jimmy Cleary, who in the Second World War was so injured that he had to have a colonoscopy himself, but nobody ever knew it. And he showed my dad, and he showed my dad how to live with it. Otto Graham, the great football player, had a colonoscopy, and he called my dad the day after he was operated on to tell him that he had it and what he went through. And he realized that there was a whole colony of people out there that he had never known about, discovered about, and that his part of his job was going to be to make sure that people understood what he had, how to live with it, and not to be afraid of it. Mm-hmm.
What kind of toll did that take on the last couple years of his life?
I think physically, he was you know, a heavy man. He weighed 250, 260 pounds. He was about 6'1". And as he got into his early 80s, you know, it took a toll. I mean, he couldn't control it all the time, you know, his mainstream. And he, you know, he was frustrated by that. But he handled it very well, and he did it with dignity.
When was the last conversation, or what was the last conversation like with your father?
That's a very moving question. My father went to the hospital to have a checkup, a physical checkup. That's all it was. And he was in bed because they wanted to keep him overnight to do various tests and so forth. And I went in to visit him, and I brought some coffee ice cream with him because that was his favorite ice cream. And a female nurse came in, and she said, "Mr. Speaker, when did you have your stroke?" He said, "I never had a stroke." She said, "Oh, yes, you did. You had it probably 4 or 5 months ago." And he said, I never had a stroke." About 10 minutes later, he said, "You know, my shoulder hurts, Tommy. Rub it." And I started to rub it, and I called him. I called him the nurse, and the nurse said, "Keep him awake." And I said, "Okay." And I realized he was having a heart attack. And he died about 15 minutes later with a whole phalanx of doctors and nurses trying to revive him. The conversation we had was about Boston College. The football game, a team at Boston College, had a great year that year. He was an avid sports fan, but he loved his Boston College as well. As we all did, we all went to BC except for one brother. Except for one sister, excuse me. So that was very much a part of his life. And we talked about the great year they were having. And he talked about the young quarterback for Boston College who was married into a neighborhood store owner from North Cambridge's family. In other words, the quarterback from Boston College married the young daughter of the donut maker across the street from the church that we attended, and how good those donuts were, and what it meant to him and the family when he'd pick up a dozen donuts after church and go home for making a breakfast and eating those donuts. And how he told me that he used to eat half the bag of donuts before he got home because he loved them so much. I mean, it was something. Mm. That was the conversation.
I've never heard that before. That's very, very interesting. To be there when your father, larger-than-life man, is departing, you're certainly not expecting it. You're just going to visit him.
That's right.
What is that like to be there when that's going on, and you're just bringing him ice cream, coming to visit?
So, what I had to think about was not only his passing, but making sure that my mom, who was alone on the Cape, was going to be taken care of, because I knew the moment he died, the story would break. And so I had to corral my family and friends of my mother's on the Cape, her sister, and get her to the house before that story broke, just to comfort my mother. Mm. And then I called the family and told them to come to the hospital, and we had to make arrangements that night. And just to get ahead of the press, that's all.
Right. When somebody dies that big, it is your father, but what were the days following it like? The news stories, President Clinton issued a very nice statement, the funeral itself attended by a lot of dignitaries.
First of all, the press was wonderful. The conservative press in Boston went out of their way to be very generous and gracious, as did the Globe and all the news outlets. The national TV shows, the news accounts were very flattering. And it made, I think, life for my mother very easy, or easier than it normally would have been. And I think the family preparing for the wake and the funeral, the wake at the State House, he was viewed in state in the Hall of Flags at the State House, and it was a very cold week. It was sub-zero, and the throngs of people that came to view my father in his state was just an amazing thing. It went on for hours and hours and hours with thousands of people coming by. And that was the week. I mean, it was occupied, so it was so occupied with activities and things that needed to be done that I think it helped his family get past his death that week, to be very honest.
Wanted to go back real quick to the 92 election, the last election he was alive for. That was a big year. Clinton, sitting president George H.W. Bush, and Ross Perot. What did he make of those candidates?
He thought Clinton was a game changer, who understood the business of politics and how to get elected and how to campaign. He loved his nature. He knew Bill Clinton when he was a governor, and he came to understand and appreciate his ascendance, but his common touch as well. My father had a great common touch, but so did Bill Clinton. And, you know, he became a lion in the Democratic Party. I think he appreciated that. He loved George Bush. I told you that earlier, because they had been friends. But, you know, he supported Clinton because he was a Democrat and he believed in it.
One question I wanted to ask about Ronald Reagan. Your father and President Reagan were obviously very close, and there's been a lot of question in recent years about President Reagan's Alzheimer's and issues when he was in office. Did your father ever say anything about President Reagan as far as not being quite with it when he was president?
No, I don't remember any of that, to be very honest with you. And if he had said something, it would have stuck with me. I don't think he was ever critical of it or ever caught it. I think Ronald Reagan's family caught it before anybody else, to be very honest with you. And if there was a cover-up, they did it very well.
How did your father's political career influence or impact your political career?
Well, I think much in the same way that it impacted his. I mean, he was a child of FDR and Al Smith. I was a child of my dad and Jack Kennedy, and loved the politics. I mean, Kennedy moved America, at least Northeast America, and certainly Massachusetts and Boston. And we had a whole generation of people who went into government and politics. The year I was elected to the state legislature, it was the largest class in state history of state legislators coming in. There were 68 of us, a huge number, and a huge change. And basically, it was because of Richard Nixon and the Vietnam War. People wanted change, and we knew it. But the change had been coming a long time through Jack Kennedy, through LBJ, and some of his domestic programs, which were so important. The peace movement, the deaths of Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and Jack Kennedy. Those were motivating events that moved a whole generation.
You know, it's hard to know this, but in today's world, what would your father have thought of what's going on today? Wars in Iran, the president ignoring court decisions, the Democrats not having much of a position right now. What would he have thought of all this?
He would think it disgraceful. He would view, I think, the president as being pathetic, to be very honest with you. I think that says enough.
How would your father like to be remembered? How do you remember your father?
As somebody who was a role model, as somebody that people really loved and admired, as somebody who helped people continuously, as somebody who was, his whole life in politics was to help man, you know, the poor and the middle class succeed in life. That's all he cared about.
What is something we don't know about him from his life, or maybe a story we don't know?
He did the Merv Griffin show, and this is at a point where Ronald Reagan and he are the Republican leadership, and he are at war, and it's just before a mid-year election. And he went, and the issue was Social Security. The Reagan people wanted to cut Social Security. He wanted to maintain it. And he did any number of the shows that you referred to. This is before the book came out, of course. But he did the Merv Griffin show one day. And America really did not know him before he did the show, but I'll never forget the line. Merv Griffin said, "I understand you play golf." My father said, "Yes. Played the other day." And he said, "You know, I missed a shot putt." And he said, "You know, I play with my good friend Andy Aside, the Undertaker. When I was a little upset over missing that shot putt, Andy Aside turned to him and said, 'You know, Tip, I buried a guy this morning that would have loved to have missed that putt.'" Merv Griffin was in an uproar. The audience went crazy, and they played that piece on TV about 10 times. But it showed a side of my father that America had never seen before, and they loved it.
That is a great story. Tom, before I let you go here, I want you to tell one more story here, because I hear that your father, when he would give a speech, an after-dinner speech, had a favorite story he would like to close with involving Henry Ford.
He was asked by Jack Kennedy to go to the unveiling of the statue of John Paul Jones in Ireland to represent the American government. So he took us all over, and we got picked up in a car, a limousine, over in Ireland, and we were in Cork. And my father said, "What's that building over there?" And the driver said, "That's the Cork Hospital. There's a wonderful story about it. Henry Ford came here 40 years ago." So it's back in the 20s, and he said, "You know, we knocked on the hotel door of Henry Ford and asked him for a donation for the new hospital to be built in the center of Cork. So Ford made out a check for $5,000, and he gave it to them, and he said, 'I hope this helps.' The next day in the Cork Examiner, the newspaper, a blazing headline, 'Henry Ford gives $50,000 to the city of Cork for their hospital.'" And so they were pretty cute, the Irish. They knocked on Ford's door to apologize and said, "Mr. Ford, we're going to have that story retracted in tomorrow's paper. It'll be a headline that you didn't do it, you gave us five." Henry Ford said, "How much do you really need?" And they said, "Well, it turns out that we need $50,000. So he said, "Give me back the check for five." He made out a check for $50,000, and he said, "You can have the check on one condition, that over the door, over the portal of the door, you inscribe the words, 'I came amongst you, and you took me in.'"
That is a great, great story. And I'm sure a lot of people have stolen that story over the years for many speeches. Tom, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show this morning, remembering your father. And he certainly deserves to be remembered. He is a great guy. And if you don't remember Tip O'Neill or don't know Tip O'Neill, go to YouTube or go to Google. Search him out. Listen to him. He is fun to watch. Tom, thank you so much.
Scott, thanks for being so kind. Nice to talk to you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye.
Tom O'Neill, the oldest son of former Speaker of the House Tip O'Neill, and Tom himself, former state legislator and lieutenant governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Bob, you got a wrap-up of that interview before we close the show down today?
It was a very good interview. He's a very interesting person. I might have to look up the Tip O'Neill book and read it.
Yes, and he did. He wrote two books, and they're both very good. And check out that Donahue on YouTube. It is a funny, funny show, Tip O'Neill and Donahue. All right, Bob, thanks for coming in today, and we thank Tom O'Neill for being the guest. For this day, Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Look for us on Facebook and